C, and it's a term that I don't like very much. And I think that maybe as to point, one point of connection is that, of course, on the one hand, Nancy at the very end of the text, I tried to account for the, or at least tried to brush against the way in which the question of politics ultimately becomes one of what he calls deposing or dislodging the foundations of value as a certain calculable notion of wealth. But I think the question of real wealth maybe is what Nancy is really at stake for Nancy in the question of communism. But real wealth certainly doesn't mean the production of use values or something like that, but rather something that's sort of unproducible in a certain sense. And maybe that's the kind of name for this kind of excess over over the calculable or over a certain idea of the form of value. I mean, Nancy never uses this kind of very strict, you know, classical sort of Marxist idiom, both, well, for good reasons. I mean, it's not a question of avoidance necessarily, but he wants to inscribe the question of value into a larger sort of, as he says, a kind of civilizational question, which is probably a weakness, but it's also it's a strategic question for him as a philosophical account of communism. The other thing is the question of pre-social, which is interesting because in a way, that's a very difficult term because obviously for Nancy, communism or even what he used to call community in the earlier work in the 80s, is precisely that which has to be posed as some sort of excess over the social, understood as the sort of distribution of power or wealth or what have you. I mean, what Hegel calls simply the kind of realm of necessity, right? Like that's a space in which the only social relations are relations mediated by exchange, money, value, and so on. But the question for me ultimately is what exactly is the nature of that relationship? Is it an antagonistic relationship in which the social has a certain way of again, producing wealth and distributing wealth? Is that something that has to, in a certain sense, be destroyed in order for something like a figure or a certain kind of notion of communism to emerge as a historical, you know, whatever moment? Or is there some other kind of relationship between those two terms? And again, I think that at the beginning of Nancy's account of the relationship between society and communism, it's a very non-antagonistic and even non-transitive relationship between society and community. But I think as his work progresses, he gets closer to a certain kind of notion, not of antagonism, but a kind of deployment of force as a kind of necessary condition for something like the emergence of, or the kind of appearance, maybe is the better word, of something like communism. And so, and then the final point I just simply say is that the notion of the common necessarily has a kind of imminent conflictuality that sort of structures the experience or the process of the common. And that's a very important point for Nancy, and I think that for him, the question of class struggle, you know, class division, has to be thought from the perspective and within the horizon of that question of the kind of internal conflictuality of communism. And it's something that, of course, I think would have implications if one could follow through this kind of relationship to Marxism and the history of Marxism. So,
I'll respond to your comments. I don't think this surplus population is outside the working class. It's an integral part of the working class. It comes from the working class, and more it will come from very high paid, relatively speaking, sectors of the working class. So it's not a question of posing it as a new class separable from the working class. And the question of material wealth or real wealth as opposed to value, it's a use value, if you want to continue to use that term. It could be aesthetic, it could be a well-cooked meal or a great glass of wine, it could be a loving relationship. All of those are part of the real wealth of humankind. They're not just what is produced in a factory or with a laptop computer. I think what Marx is getting at is freeing ourselves from that kind of labor, even if it is a labor that produces use values that sustain life in a biological sense, and expanding needs and expanding relationships. So I wouldn't want to pigeonhole material wealth or real wealth as simply being products, more refrigerators, more cars, more houses, or things of that order.
And with that, ghettos as kind of sites of a surplus population. And I was wondering how you kind of square that with the feminization of labor, because, I mean, there's actually a huge gender gap if you look in those areas in terms of who's not working and
right.
who is working, because, for instance, black women are very much integrated into the service
uh-huh.
economy, and there's a huge gap in terms of rates of graduation from college
uh-huh.
and unemployment. So I'm wondering how that fits into your analysis of that space as kind of surplus.
Well, I think you're right, there's a gender gap, and I think I need to take note of that explicitly. But I don't think a change, I think the same gender gap probably exists in urban slums in the South, where women are doing household work as maids or cleaners, and where the men in their lives have no possibility of work, or only dealing in drugs or in gangs. I think it's a really important issue. I agree with you.
As much the form that you presented it in, which made it impossible not to be both impacted, both in terms of understanding, but also inspired to do something about it. I hope with me you're all going to rush out of here and begin to get more active in the class struggle. Having said all that, what needs to be done, and I expect you've already given a lot of thought to this, is the way in which the main characteristics you attribute to the present situation, both on the side of what's happening with jobs and the role that technology plays, but also what's happening in terms of the collective, or a bigger and bigger section of the collective working class. How does this particular development impact, first of all, in the way that capitalism has chosen to continue to control these people in terms of bread and circuses, the current version thereof, and more and more wars, which has the very important role of taking out some of the more violent members of that group that you described,
mm-hmm.
and giving them training so that they can at least get jobs as policemen and prison guards
yeah.
in the future capitalist society when they come out, if they come out
yeah.
from these wars, but not only in terms of how capitalism has reacted to developing more effective means of control, but also what are the main contradictions you see which create the possibilities of work with these groups because the trade unions, at least as currently organized and controlled, don't get into working with these people at all, and in fact antagonize them by accepting two-tier wage contracts. But also the political parties to the left of the Democratic Party haven't shown, as far as I know, any real successes in organizing. So what new forms of organization are made possible by this, not just greater contradiction, but in some ways even a new contradiction, which has developed in the period of modern capitalism, in the advanced capitalist world?
Yeah, I wish I had an answer to that question. But you're right, you asked the right question, without a doubt. All I can perhaps do is make a couple of points, and they're weak and feeble at best, but I think you point in the right direction. On the one hand, because the drive for accumulation and to extract more and more relative surplus value takes as one of its forms a development of the material productive forces, those who produce or work in those sectors become extremely important, an integral part of the collective worker. The question is there something in their Leibniz, in their life experience that will propel them in the direction of seeing this contradiction in which they are caught, because they're relatively well paid, even though fewer in number, and yet will obviously have a pivotal role, I would imagine. Just as at one point it was steel workers or auto workers who would have had, or workers in the Putilov factory in Petrograd in 1917 who had a pivotal role. But the second thing is, in some way or other, links have to be forged with this consolidated surplus population, lest it be mobilized by capital itself. And that is the real danger. And the question that I focused on, and it doesn't begin to answer your question, it's an invitation, your question that is, but what I did begin to focus on is who is best adept at controlling or mobilizing those very social forces. And wherever I look, in whatever country I look, those countries are more successful at imposing draconian austerity that have left governments than have right governments. It's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, the new Irish government includes the Labour Party. It is imposing the most draconian austerity on the population of Ireland that has ever been seen. The government in Athens is Papandreou's socialist government. It is imposing, even if it were to say we're going to default on our debt and we're going to opt out of the euro, which is at least a possibility, though I don't think it's going to happen. But even if they took that route, it wouldn't change the fact that it would mean draconian austerity for the Greek working class and the mass of the Greek population. I don't think a right government can nearly as easily get away with that. Cameron is fortunate that he has liberal Democrats, as well as the fact that Labour has offered no alternative. In the United States, I think Capitol is extremely fortunate that Barack Obama is sitting in the White House and not John McCain. Of course, we all know that McCain was not born in the United States. So he couldn't sit in the White House, having been born in Panama. But even if we put that aside, I mean, really, I don't think the austerity we are going to see that's now being negotiated with Wall Street would have been possible had there been a McCain presidency. I don't think anyone but the UAW could have renegotiated those auto contracts. So I think one danger, and I grant you it doesn't begin to answer your question, but one danger is to recognize what a foe the left represents. This is not 1914. This is not Eugene V. Debs. This is not that world. This is a different world. And in this world, the left can play a role that in many, many cases the right can't play. I think it's true in India. I think that had the Hindu nationalists been in power, India would have much greater difficulty in negotiating its way through the kind of austerity that is being imposed, even as the economy grows. I think if Lula hadn't been able to choose his successor in Brazil, had the right won, it would have been a much more difficult time for Brazilian capitalism. So I would at least point to that danger as one that people on the left, Marxists, have to rethink because it breaks down their inclinations, their traditional inclinations. I was at an anarchist conference 2 years ago, and one of the speakers, an anarchist who doesn't believe there should be any state, said, "My wife is trying to get me to vote for Barack Obama." I mean, what do you do? I mean, how can an anarchist? I mean, there's no place to go when you do that. So.
I guess I wanted to push. It's like a reciprocal question to the speakers. I wanted to push Jason a little more on this question of, of whether this distinction in Marx between value and material wealth, right, is one kind of interesting precursor in some sense, right? That actually, Alan, I have a copy of your paper. You didn't read the last line about how the left has persisted in thinking of the horrors of capitalism as an unequal distribution of value rather than as a problem of the very existence of wage labor and the value form, etc.
Thank you for reading that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting this question of, well, you know, maybe we need to think through more fully material wealth in a way that, you know, just to kind of, well, there's a simple way of thinking about it that's somehow inadequate to the question of communism, right? The distribution of material wealth is like not just the distribution of things, but of something that like sets that situation up. But I guess I wanted to push you on this question, which is that what about the results, though, of Alan's presentation? That is to say, does the actual situation in which capitalism seems to be sort of like spinning out or, you know, kind of going into decline, does that affect the the vision. I mean, could one have had this understanding of communism, for example, 100 years ago or something? I mean, is there a historical, it's a philosophical project to think through the question of communism, but in this way that Nancy is doing it. But is there a historical specificity of it that has to do with the way that capitalism is, the contradiction of capitalism, whatever you want to call that, are appearing in this period? And then the inverse question is for Alan, which is, does the way that, you know, you presented a kind of sense of the way that capitalism is spinning out of control or going into decline, obviously a version of this that I'm quite amenable to, does our understanding, however, of the politics that responds to this situation, right, this kind of emergency situation, require a kind of like thinking through of the situation of communism? I mean, is the presence of communism as a kind of horizon of this situation, right, like present in this situation, does that somehow affect the analysis? Do you know what I mean? Like a real thinking through of what it would mean to live beyond the existence mm-hmm. of the wage labor, the value form, etc.
I guess I'll start, and I don't really have a very good question, so or a very good response. So
I'll be shorter, I'm sure. I mean, I think that, like, you know, in terms of the historical question, I mean, unfortunately, for better or for worse, I mean, Nancy's conception of communism as a kind of something that needs to be thought really emerges in the wake of the kind of exhaustion, if you like, of the kind of Soviet experience, I think. And so for me, ultimately, his conception of communism is oriented around the political question of communism, ultimately the question of power, the question of state. And so that's why there's, like, in his, you know, the earliest work in the early 80s, I think there's this real kind of asymmetry and a kind of almost disconnection between the question of community as a certain horizon within which the question of communism has to be posed, and the notion of society, because there's a real attempt to sort of, in a certain sense, divorce the question of communism from these kind of material conditions, I think, that you're making reference to, both the material questions of a kind of the labor process and the sort of thing, and the transformation of the labor process, but also for the question of struggles. And I think that's, I think this is actually quite interesting to me that, I mean, from a political perspective, I always see the question of communism as having to be posed from the perspective and arising from out of actual struggles that are occurring. And so the question, the content of communism emerges through that process. But as a philosophical reflection on communism, I think it's a different problem. And that's why, on the one hand, you develop a kind of ontological question in which, in a certain sense, the problem of communism isn't something that's projected as a horizon, but it's simply what's there as something that has to be addressed, if you like, as something that's a fact as much as it is a kind of demand. And so I think that's really the question. And so, I mean, but the problem for me is, as someone who sort of spends time on either side of that fence, is that I want to somehow bring to a kind of proximity, but also to a kind of real breaking point, these two different ways of thinking about how communism is produced as a kind of theoretical framework. On the one hand, this philosophical reflection on something that, in a certain sense, transcends and both precedes and long, you know, yeah, transcends is maybe the right term, the entire question of capitalism, value form, money, all this kind of, even the question of wealth in a certain sense. Although Nancy's very interested in the idea of value and also richesse, I mean, wealth, a certain way of thinking about wealth. But on the other hand, I really do believe that the question of communism cannot be posed outside of a determined sequence of struggles, and that the very content of communism is produced by the struggles themselves. And so somehow bringing those two questions together has been very difficult for me, just as personally thinking about this question. But I'm very interested in that possibility, because, I mean, most of my Marxist friends would tend to just dismiss the philosophical framework altogether. And I think they're right, but I think it's also a weakness if you can be right and somehow, you know, not emasculate, but whatever the proper term is, somehow limit yourself. And I could point to specific examples. I mean, the question of wealth, I do think, has to be thought outside of a certain kind of dogmatic, or not dogmatic, but let's say inherited Marxist problematic. I think even the question of struggle has to be thought outside of a kind of Marxist framework. And what that means, that means a lot of things. And I think a lot of Marxists are thinking about that, actually. So, yeah, that's a kind of I don't know, sort of circumventing way of addressing the question. But I think that's where Nancy's coming from, and that's the problem I have, but also the interest I have in the way in which he poses the problem. So.
I guess I see two things in your question. Well, the first is the question of period. I don't think it would have been possible to think these thoughts in any old period. I said in my paper that we've only first begun to read Marx in the present era because it's only now that the manuscripts have been published as Marx wrote them. But if we do a thought experiment and we imagine that they were all published in the 1860s or the 1870s, would they have been read the way we can read them today? And I think my answer is no. They would have been read more or less in the same way as they were read by the Second International, as a brief for the development of the productive forces of the existing science and technology. They would have been read in a scientistic fashion, in a positivistic fashion. And I think it's because the period has changed, confronted us with new issues, that it's possible to go to those manuscripts today and read them in the way that people are reading them. So I certainly don't think the problem lies, oh, if only Engels hadn't decided to change the manuscript to Volume 3, or if only we had had Volume 1 as Marx originally intended it, or if only we had the whole manuscript, the whole 1861-63 manuscript, or if the Grundrisse had dropped down into our hands in 1914, everything would have been different. I don't think so. I don't know if that's even, is it a response? Okay. So, but then to link up to Nancy, because I think there is a link. I mean, one of the things that for me is so strongly imprinted on traditional Marxism or orthodox Marxism is this faith in science and technology. This unquestioning view that, I mean, it's there in the preface. If the productive forces, the material productive forces, by which Marx was talking in large part about science and technology, if they continue to grow, then capitalism is progressive. And I think what was missed is the fact that there is a link between the science and technology that has been spawned by capitalism and that we see emerging in the 17th century and the value form. They're not separable. I mean, Alfred Sohn Rethel and many others have written, Adorno has, on the link between the very ways in which we see the material world and the value form. And I think traditional Marxism has never seen that. It has worshipped at the shrine of science and technology to the point that I don't think there's a bourgeois theorist who could outdo a Second International, a Third International Marxist in their appreciation of science and technology. And I guess I was going to ask you, how far do you see the link between a Nancy and a Heidegger on some of these issues?
Obviously, the mode of, let's say, philosophical address is clearly Heideggerian. This kind of step back into the essence of something, which is precisely what he's doing, you know, right? This question of thinking communism through a kind of step back into this, some kind of historical, but not in the kind of material sense of the term, but in a kind of more, let's say, ontological framework. So that's clearly there, but I think the problems are different for those two. I mean, clearly Heidegger was very concerned at a very specific point with the question of the political, and particularly he used to think it through Antigone, passage from Antigone, if you know this, some of the section of the 30s. But I think the question of communism is, I mean, for Heidegger, and he was thinking in terms of the kind of Soviet experience and the kind of American experience. So for him, they were sort of these kind of, which is, you can find different versions of that thesis on the left, obviously. But I don't think the questions are very similar. I mean, I think the mode of thought is very similar. That's the style of thought and the a commitment to thinking historically certain kinds of problems, historically in the kind of Heideggerian sense. And maybe that addresses on some level why it is that Nancy thinks communism not from the perspective of and from within a kind of struggles, but from a kind of some other kind of, from some other position. But yeah, I mean, he's not a man of the left in the kind of classical
not in the movement, as they say. You know, he's someone who's on the sympathetic, fellow traveler, whatever the term is. But so yeah, left Heideggerian, I guess. If you want to make it simple.
Can I just add one more point, because I forgot to say it? I mean, it's not only the publication of those so-called economic manuscripts, but let's say Marx had decided to publish the Paris manuscripts of 1844. How would the question of alienation have been illuminated? Or would it have been? Or did it take a different epoch to read those manuscripts and see the question of alienation in terms that wouldn't have been apparent in the 1840s, but became apparent by the 1930s.
It's interesting to me as a writer to listen to this discussion and to hear language used in the way that it's being used. For instance, intentionality of the author of Marx is very questionable to me. How one can think in those terms now, but I wanted to say to Jason that I think how you presented your paper was very appealing to me, because it was trying to think through arguments that and try to change language in such a way, or work with how language might in itself show change in the way that we continue to think. I feel often that, you know, when I hear words like evil or danger or this is dangerous, you know, it's what, you know, if I hear the word culture and I reach for my gun, you know, was it Goebbels or Goering, and then Godard took that up. So I think that the force of the argument you're trying to make is extremely subtle, to me anyway, and extremely important, because the language matters. And to me it matters a great deal, and I felt that I was hearing something that was trying to describe an ongoing situation, not something that's inert, but something that's in movement. And I think that's one of the interesting things you brought out about Nancy's philosophy.
I mean, just one remark about this, thank you, is that it's interesting that Nancy oftentimes refers to communism as a name or as a word, and not a concept. And it's already, again, from a certain perspective, that's a kind of weakness. But from another perspective, it sort of reorients the question of communism towards a kind of prescription, let's say a call, or a kind of demand, rather than a kind of framework of analysis. And I think that's something that is very important to someone like Nancy. And I think it's important to all of us, though it doesn't necessarily get posed in precisely those terms. But there was a conference called The Idea of Communism, which everyone knows sort of more or less what this is, that took place in London in 2009. He's quite sick, and so he couldn't come, but he sent a text called Communism the Word. And it's, you know, not the idea, but the word. And so, I'll just leave it like that.
I actually just wanted him to say one more line on the note of the language that you were using, actually. Could you just read that line that ended with Arche again? Because that really...
I should read that one in mid-sentence because it was a citation of text, part of the text.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So
was that your wording though, or Nancy's?
Yeah, Nancy's. Okay. Nancy, that's a very strange moment where he describes. This is something that you find in Rancière too, but he identifies a certain idea of democracy with a kind of, in a kind of strict literal sense, a kind of anarchy. I'd say the kind of absence of, or even a deposing of, any kind of philosophical principle that could order the social, whether it be wealth, intelligence, quality, these kind of qualities. But the term that I was interested in was the word depose, or foil is another term he uses. And these are terms, I always try to tease out these little moments where the language suggests this kind of force, or this kind of transitive process. Because again, as a philosopher, I think that it's very important for him to sort of address the question of force in a kind of oblique way. Because again, the problem of force
is ultimately a question of physics, you know, or mechanics or what have you. And so these moments where there are suggestions of deposing or what have you, I found to be important. And I don't know what to make of them, but I just forced things the best I could. I mean, literally.
'60s, 1860s, where he talks about if and when, and I think it was more in the sense of when, like this is not an exact quote, of they cannot employ, when the system cannot employ, most or a great or a majority of their workers, that system has definitely come to an end, with the implication for the, of revolution without using the term revolution. Mm-hmm. So he sees that already then. But this is not for the near future, I think, in that particular discussion. But there's another reason for that to occur, which he couldn't foresee, but it really belongs in your presentation, which is outsourcing. Because outsourcing really accomplishes the same goal for the capitalist. He's able to buy labor power much less, and his surplus value is greater. And now that is a rather recent development, at least to the degree, anything like the degree to which we see it around the world today. So it's that development and technology plus outsourcing, which is together responsible for this growing population which has no job. The person who sees this most sharply, by the way, is a non-Marxist, Norbert Wiener, who's often referred to as the father of automatic systems theory and automation. Back in a book of 1950, Cybernetics, where in a later edition, a few years later, he says how worried he was, because he's one of the theoreticians of what came to be automation, how worried he was about the potential of this to do away with great masses of jobs, and what is the effect this is going to have on the capital, on the system. He's not a Marxist, but he's worried about, you know, the kind of situation which has developed. And he says, this is now an edition of 1954, that he was very worried about this until he had talks with two groups of capitalists and their managers, and they assured him that they would not use these new inventions to simply, you know, it's very, no, just make profit, and they were very concerned to help, you know, workers have work less and have more free time. And he says that on this page, long discussion of this, he's much reassured. But as I say, he wasn't the Marxist, but he had it down very clear about what the potential was back in the beginning of the 1950s.
So I want to ask a question about force, because it seems that maybe one thing that you know, the line from the 59 preface did was give a very clear delineation of force, right? So force was understood as technological force, as force of production, and if in order for communism to overthrow and displace capitalism, it needed to have more force than capitalism, then what that meant, I mean, it presented a very clear notion of what communists had to do, which was industrialize, technologize, develop the forces of production and the forces of the military as well. And so you might look at that conception of technological force as like centrally important to Trotsky's strategy in the war and everything else, that in some sense looking to technological power as the locus of force was centrally important. And I mean, it set up this dynamic that, you know, then in the when the struggle went into, you know, what was called the Third World, right? And in Maoism, and you see this same thing in Fanon, there's a displacement of force, right, from technological force onto the and you see this in South America too, onto the force of desire, the force of will, the force of the collective people, who have no technology, but it doesn't matter, so that there's this displacement from technological force onto human force. And so the question of how to think about force, I mean, on the one hand is a very philosophical question, but it is also a very just a central tactical question. Like, what are how do we understand force in such a way that the planet of slums seems like a place where there is a potential, a force arrayed against capital? And what kind of force is that? And so that would, I mean, force us to think about force not just philosophically, but as a matter of physics.
As a kind of almost parenthesis, I mean, I know in Hegel, like in the Science of Logic, there's this discussion of a kind of distinction between objective force, which is relations of force, and a kind of subjectivation, or a kind of subjective force, which is this kind of infinitization of force, the interiorization of that kind of relation. So that's one way to think about, like, the first way I would pose the problem is it's really a question of not at the tactical level, obviously, as you I seem to want to have that kind of discussion, I can't. The question of posing the kind of asymmetry of an objective logic of force and a kind of subjective force. And I think maybe that shift from this kind of Trotsky or whatever in this kind of first phase you were talking about to kind of Maoism might somehow reside in that sort of center of gravity shifting a little bit. I mean, the more philosophical sort of, you know, yammering that one could imagine in a kind of Heideggerian context would be just simply sort of mulling over all the these kind of fine distinctions that one finds between question of force on the one hand, question of power on the other, and the way in which those get sort of translated. Like, for example, for me, force implies precisely this kind of economics, technology, social relations, blah, 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 whereas power is a more political question. But those terms get sort of shifted around very quickly when you start thinking about the way in which power itself can be sort of articulated in terms of a kind of another asymmetry between a certain potentiality on the one hand and a certain idea of just power, more classical sense, and so on and so forth. And so I don't know how to think through this question of force if it's not reducible to, again, this question of physics kind of mechanics, kind of science of mechanics. But I do think that question of a subjective force, which is no longer thought in terms of kind of exterior relations, a balance of power, if you like to put it in those terms, but as a kind of infinitization of force, and a kind of interiorization of force, as a kind of subjective force, which has to be thought from the perspective of its own immanent capacities, rather than in a kind of simply conflictual relation, might be a direction that I would sort of take the question. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to see how that, I mean, but it seems like they're caught in this dilemma, right, where between objective, subjective,
exterior and interior.
And what's the relation between them, right? I mean, it's the question of subjective capacity and building a revolutionary force somehow indexed to a kind of objective configuration of technological power. I'm not sure they are. I think the question ultimately is to think about the way in which those two moments are configured in a way that's not a kind of classical sort of dialectical schema. You see what I'm saying? Like, I'm not sure once the question of building a kind of subjective capacity depends upon the objective situation, the relation of force in a given situation. I'm not sure.
Actually, I just wanted to repeat Alan's question that he asked you before, because I think the question about Heidegger, maybe I think you took it in a different direction in the sense that I think I got from what he was saying, which is that there's this kind of after the orthodoxy question of Marxism in Panzieri, you know, but also weirdly in, repeated in a kind of Heidegger's question on technology in Foucault's notion of apparatus, which is this question in some sense of like, and I was talking to Rachel. touched on that this yesterday, actually, like the power relations that are inherent in the technology, right? That like when we make communism, we sort of have to make it from the position of all of this existing technology, which is like already embodies certain power relations. You know, and that like, you know, the very built infrastructure of this world is hard to imagine in some sense how you produce things not in a factory, you know, where actually we know from if you look at the history of how factories developed, that very form was a form which was designed to improve the ability of, you know, an overseer manager to control the activity, and even more so in like a system of roads or, you know, the way that a communication infrastructure exists in society. And so I'm just wondering if like how that, the Heidegger question becoming a question of technology, right? How that, and the force relations inherent in power, I don't know, I know you were making a distinction, but it's hard for me to replace it, but how that affects this question of like, you know, the way you're describing it.
You know, I don't know.
I mean, because the Heidegger question, I was thinking more in terms of a kind of almost methodological question of how one addresses history and historicity of these kinds of experiences or these terms like communism. And so the question of technology, I don't know. Again, I mean, like in Nancy's case, the term rarely, if ever, comes up in the context of this sort of discussion. Now, in other types of texts he might address, for example, he has a text on sovereignty and technology or techne. But I don't know if I could address that question seriously, to be quite honest. Like, so I just I had to bracket it. Like,
But that was the text written on the eve of the war, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It's a fantastic text.
He does go into that complex of issues in that text.
Right,
it's actually a very interesting text.
Yeah, it's written right on the eve of the first Gulf,
the first Gulf.
Assault, and. So and he was in the hospital. He's
right.
You know, he just had his heart transplanted.
Right.
And yeah, it's quite terrible. It's a very beautiful text. Period. And it's one of his best, I think. But the question of communism is not there. Even though just a year before he wrote this very important text around the question of communism, where for the first time he says in kind of slightly provocative terms that communism is not a political program; it's an ontological proposition, and you have to start from there. And which is, in a way, I mean, you could say that if you think of this kind of politics as a kind of axiomatic politics in this sort of recent Rancière about you, then you get into a question where communism is posed as a kind of given, a certain type of given, not a given in the sense of a sensible given or as a kind of given historical whatever configuration, but as a kind of maxim or as a kind of force that commands a kind of ordering of struggle.
Or in relation to anarchism and anarchism taking as like its, you know, basis of questioning the place of power and Arche.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the build, I think in a way, like, because, you know, like,
again, Nancy says, if you want it to be really, really forceful about this, you could say, well, the ontology is communist and the politics is anarchist. Like, but that would, he would totally not recognize himself in that. Precisely because I think he wants to dissociate the question of anarchy as a kind of philosophical reflection on the nature of a certain idea of politics from the history of anarchism, which precisely has this kind of phobic relationship to the question of power. And so I think that, and he addresses this question cautionary terms, which is to say that finally the question of power cannot be thought in terms of a kind of the classical rejection of the idea of power as a separate instance posed over against society, which has to be abolished or has to wither away or so on and so forth. And yet the fundamental question, as I tried to draw out, is that the question of communism has to first be thought historically in the context of what he calls a kind of withdrawal of the political, a disappearance of the political. But it's a disappearance of the political that has to be thought in terms other than a kind of classical Marxist or anarchist idea of power as that which in a future society will somehow be either absorbed into society itself or dissipated in some way.
Also, withdrawal from polity itself.
Yeah, I mean, that term, it's supposed to resonate in a lot of different ways. I mean, oftentimes they get interpreted as like, well, what these guys, they're kind of Heideggerian, and what they're trying to say is that it's necessary philosophically to in a certain sense, take a certain distance from politics as a kind of politics of struggle. But I think that in that initial project in the early 80s, that the real question was trying to think of the way in which the political, on the one hand, couldn't be thought as this kind of management of society, which is basically like what everyone more or less thinks politics is, for better or worse. But it also can't be thought in the philosophical, kind of Hegelian sense, as this kind of point of at which or through which all the contradictions and the kind of conflicts of civil society get somehow interiorized and sublated. And so if that philosophical concept of the political has, in a certain sense, been historically withdrawn from us, rather than it being something that we withdraw from, then what's at stake in that kind of clearing, you know, in that space in which that philosophical figure, the political, gets is withdrawn. You know. So.
We have 10 minutes left. I don't know if people have any more questions or just want to start with general discussion. That's the topic pertaining to the time. Or just the general thematic.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, a totally speculative question, but in your presentation, it seemed like you ended up putting quite a bit of emphasis on the organization and control of the slum planet by gangs and by especially narcotics gangs, it seems, right? Or at least gangs that are engaged in trafficking. So to what extent do you think a recapture of some of the surplus population might be available to capitalism through a strategy of legalizing narcotics? Right? I don't know, cavalier, but I like, to what extent is the unofficial or the gray economy or the black economy of these areas able to be reintegrated, whitened up by coming under the law again?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, when Mario Vargas Llosa ran for president of Peru, it now seems ages ago, I mean, his big idea was that the informal economy is the real economy and it can become the springboard for prosperity for the masses of Peruvians. I think he had no idea of how capitalism makes that impossible and how far the informal economy is locked into certain kinds of practices that would not make that possible. I certainly didn't want to imply that the primary means of control was narco-terrorist gangs or anything like that. I think in some places it plays a significant role, in other places it doesn't. Can it employ, can that part of the informal economy employ this surplus population? I think its numbers are growing so rapidly that it's highly unlikely. I mean, I just don't see it. I think it's more likely that that they have a militaristic function of playing one group against the other and of guaranteeing control in that sense than providing some kind of employment for masses of people who can't be otherwise employed. But I have to admit, I don't know enough about it. I don't see that as a way out for capitalism, although it's interesting to think about Philip Morris going into the pot business, and now we'll see doctors in white coats on television urging you to smoke a joint, maybe.
What about the progressive tendencies that exist, and do you see them as in these slums. We've talked about all of the ways in which they are used, manipulated, held back, but of course that's can't be the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see happening which you think might present us with the germs of the possibility of there getting involved in some anti-systemic action?
I do. I mean, I'm not prepared to go into much detail, but it seems to me that we have to, in another paper I wrote, which I think you've read, but it doesn't play a big role in it. I think we have to look for where in the collective laborer, the collective worker, Marx's Gesamtarbeiter, in all its forms, there are revolutionary sparks. I think they exist in the actual life experience of people in those situations, whether they're working in Silicon Valley or they're living in Compton. The question is to try to find where in those life experiences that revolutionary spark can be ignited. Now, I know I sound almost like I'm a religious freak saying, I know the spark is there, and but yeah, but that's okay. So that's the question, where? But I think there is, you know, people, for example, will say to me, well, look at all these kids in the ghetto. They don't know math. They don't, you know, in Compton, they can't add. You know, they do a pretty good job. You know, when you go to buy a few ounces of pot and you give them 50 cents, they don't give you a nickel back. They understand quite well how to do math. I think those skills and those capabilities exist in a very rich way in the planet of slums, but how can they be activated? How can the people themselves tap into those resources? I don't have a simple answer for you. I think, it's another one of those questions. But I'm not looking for other groups to liberate those people who live in the planet of slums. I think there are elements within them that provide a key to that possibility. But sitting here tonight, I'm not sure I could give you a coherent example.
Well, what about spontaneous rebellions when they're starving? And there's a great number of them starving on the verge of starvation. Who are they going to attack? I mean, they have purposely kept far away from any group or place they could attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and I think that is the way capital will seek to handle the situation and hope that it indeed takes that form. But are there other possibilities? I think there must be. But as I say, I'm sitting here tonight, I don't think I could give you a coherent account of it, but I think it's exactly the kind of issue that needs to be pursued by Marxists. And not with a Fanonian romanticism of rage, as if, well, the solution lies in picking up the knife and driving it into the head of this group or that group who are your purported exploiters. But I think that passion and that need and those, maybe the word is powers, exists. The question is how it can be activated. And I honestly don't have a simple answer.
Couldn't you say these people are also representative of many ways of what Marx referred to as the lumpen proletariat, who are more easily brought out
to the questions here?
Sorry.
Well, there's a side that could make them a dangerous stratum, but there's another side that could potentially activate them, I think, in a revolutionary direction. And it's a question of distinguishing between the two. Not easy to do.
I was just going to point out quickly that in California, when they're talking about legalizing pot, you know, there are all these very rich people up in Humboldt County who make their living off of pot selling. And they realized that if the pot was legalized, price was going to collapse.
Hmm.
And so they invented this whole story about how natural pot is, like, so much better, and they were really worried about,
green pot.
Yeah, they were really worried about, manufacturing, getting to pot, But anyway, it just made me think, because I think it's like the question somehow reveals something, because obviously the reason why, there wouldn't be any jobs, right, obviously, in drug dealing, the drugs were legalized. And the reason that why that's the case is because the jobs that exist are there because they're dangerous, right? It's the fact that they're extremely dangerous that makes them jobs that superfluous people end up in. And I think it kind of goes back, the reason why I say this is because it goes back to what Laura said before, right? It's like, why are there jobs that are feminized? You know, what does it mean to say feminized job? Not the quality of the job itself, right? It's something about the way that women are integrated into the labor market, right? That kind of renders something called feminized labor. And so, you know, these are the, I don't know, that's just anyway some indication of the direction I think we can give. Thank you.